Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of July. Duncan Merle has a current piece in this month's Harper's Magazine, In the Year of the Storm, The Topography of Resurrection in New Orleans. He went to New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina struck and spent almost a year there. This is what he thought he would find, he said. He wanted to go get the story of what happened to a city that had experienced this. He had time to get the story, he said, and he thought he knew what the story would be. We'll find out if what he thought was what was true. Chaos, he writes, would resolve itself through conflict into redemption and inspiration. The people of New Orleans would endure their trials. Their resilience would be known in their success. I would find the place full of tough and contrary people in love with their city. Headsuckers and rosary prayers and maskers all. Such a place, never overcome in 300 years of disease and high water, could only make good. Duncan is our guest the first hour of our program today, and we'll welcome phone calls for him. He's an interesting life, had an interesting life. He's a writer now living in North Carolina, served 4 years as a Marine Corps artillery officer in the early 90s. Since then, he's worked as a newspaper reporter, an acquisitions editor at Algonquin Books, a golf range attendant, and a magazine writer. He's worked at newspapers in Alabama, Washington, D.C., and North Carolina, and has written for Harper's, Poets and Writers, The Oxford American, Mother Jones, Southern Cultures, Men's Fitness, and other magazines, and has also appeared on Talk of the Nation's Science Friday. Our phone number as we talk about New Orleans, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Hello, Duncan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
So did you find the place full of tough and contrary people still in love with their city?
Oh, sure, I did. But they did not have as much success, I think, in that year as they would have liked to have had. Had far more to overcome, I think, than they thought when they first arrived back after the storm had receded.
You know, it's interesting, and I'm trying to think of any other city in the country, maybe there are some, who have the vast array of terribly interesting people that New Orleans has. The people you write about, I don't know if it's just because you're a writer and you can find these people or if it's something about New Orleans, is it?
I do believe that there's something about New Orleans that has, since the very beginning, since 1718, attracted outsiders or just people who want to live in a place that is utterly unlike, you know, any other place in the United States. And part of that about New Orleans is that it's simply geographically different. It's a subtropical city. It has had it has a West Indian, Caribbean, Creole feel to it that you don't find anywhere else. And it lends itself to a certain pace of life and a certain way of life that it's hard to find. Although you find it in little pockets all throughout the United States, but it's hard to find it so concentrated. So yes, it does. It does attract interesting people. I was told by a guy who, for a long time, was he jumped trains all around the country and considered himself part of the freak culture. And in New Orleans, they called them street punks. And he said that New Orleans was in the southeast, one of the three, one of the three nodes of the freak sort of circuit, and that was included Asheville, New Orleans, and Austin, Texas. But New Orleans was by far the most popular because the weather was better.
Asheville's on the list, huh?
Well, Asheville's making is gaining as a freak center. Yes, as they begin to develop that downtown down there.
Tell me about the woman that you maybe were driving a little bit too fast, but the woman when you enter New Orleans, who, as you write, stands watching your headlights run up on her light eyes and skin that could have been black or white, the woman who you subsequently had quite a few conversations with.
Yeah. Well, she was a regular in the neighborhood, alternately homeless and not homeless, but had grown up in that neighborhood, which was the Upper Ninth Ward, part of the Ninth Ward that people call the Upper Ninth Ward. She was she had family all over the place in the city, and her family had went back a long time, and you know, she was wise in a way, but you know, profoundly unable to take care of herself. So you come across a lot of people like that in New Orleans, or at least I did.
You rode your bicycle, and you write so beautifully about this, that you're riding your bicycle over the remnants of all the old slate roofs that are powdered and chipped and lying in the street. Tell me what you saw as you... People who I've talked to who have been there, I have not been there, say that it is just an overwhelming experience.
Well, you know, I began with, first of all, I went to live in an old Creole neighborhood downriver of the French Quarter. And these houses were quite old. They were mostly 19th century shotguns or Creole cottages or two-story townhomes. And most of them were not, most of that neighborhood was not flooded. If it got any water, it got a foot or so. But even so, I mean, you have to remember that there was a hurricane. By the time that it crossed land near to the east of New Orleans, it was a Category 1 or Category 2. And the winds, you know, ripped the roofs off of places. And so, you know, these places had old slate roofs that had been there forever. And that stuff just crumbles and cracks and powders. So I started from there in this little part of the city that was not terribly damaged, but you could see signs of it. Trash on the streets. I mean, people who were clearing out their homes would have to pile up their trash on the streets. And then I sort of branched out from there and ultimately ended up spending a lot of time in the Lower Ninth Ward and also in the neighborhoods of Lakeview and Gentilly, which were, if you wanted to pick three neighborhoods, were the ones most terribly destroyed. The Lower Ninth was leveled like a tidal wave that had gone through it. In fact, that was probably the best way to describe it. A very large breach had gone through there and had picked up houses and moved them around and put them on top of cars, or cars ended up flipped over and on top of houses. I mean, it was just a very bizarre-looking place, but it was also, you know, it was somewhat familiar in that if you've ever seen, you know, the remnants of a bomb going off or something like that, that's what it looks like. The other parts of the other two neighborhoods were a little creepier, a lot creepier, in that the houses still stood and had not been moved for the most part, but they had sat in 8 to 12 feet of water for 3 to 4 weeks, and you know, these neighborhoods, mile after mile, were utterly desolate, deserted, and I found that the hardest to accept. You know, it was not a landscape that I had ever seen before. You know, miles and miles and miles of neighborhoods where there was no one. But the houses were still there, and their stuff was still there.
And so did you see, I know you were there about 8 months, close to a year, did you see people come back?
I did, slowly, and, of course, slower than I had hoped. And I think that most everyone hoped. In those neighborhoods, what you began to see after a few months was you began to see many more of those ubiquitous white, or the white FEMA trailers that then became ubiquitous. At first, in January, they were sort of hard to come by. You didn't see them a lot. But then they really started moving into these neighborhoods. So you started to see people puttering around, working on their houses, doing what they could, and living out of these FEMA trailers out in these neighborhoods. So that was the first time that people were coming back. And then some people were able to get some serious work done on their houses. You know, they had their own means to do it in the Lakeview neighborhood and Gentilly specifically. They were able to rebuild, whether or not their insurance companies wanted to help them out. And, you know, some of those people were pretty heroic because they ended up building or rebuilding houses not only on a block that was abandoned, but in a whole neighborhood that was abandoned. There would be no one around for you know, 3, 4, 5 blocks.
Goodness. And why did they want to come back?
That's the eternal question. I mean, why does anyone want to return home? There is a very profound connection that people have with New Orleans. It was known to sociologists as a city with in America with an uncommon attachment. That is, the subsequent generations of people, even to this point, to modern day, continue to return to New Orleans, to stay in New Orleans. Now, part of that's because the poor. It's a poor city, and the poor aren't terribly mobile, but that doesn't cover it all. And people feel really attached to the place. I mean, many generations of I constantly met people whose families went back many generations, and who had become identified with New Orleans for one reason or another. And you know, the farther you got away from the city, the less that unique identity of being a New Orleanian was possible. So, you know, I think this is true of anyone who feels attached to the place that they live. They begin to feel, like a fish out of water someplace else. And what people wanted when they came back was that, you know, they realized that it would be difficult, but, you know, there would be some steady progress that would take them to ultimately at some point in the future something like normalcy.
Right.
And that's what I'm afraid is going to take a lot longer than people realize.
Mm-hmm. One day the president came to town, you write. You went down to Jackson Square to see a demonstration. You'd seen angry people and sad people, but you hadn't seen organized people. And you're seeing signs, fix the coast or we are toast.
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting day. I was very I was very pleased to see that, and I subsequently met the woman who had organized that rally. That rally was mostly girls from Sacred Heart Academy uptown. They bussed them down, the nuns came down with them, and the reason why was because the organizers' daughters went to school there. And they came out, and they had practiced, were well versed in coming up with cheers for athletic events, so they just turned that into doing the same thing for agitating for levee reform and coastal restoration. And it was really something really remarkable. You got the idea from these young women, between the ages of 14 and 18, I guess, that they just really loved this place that they were growing up in.
Hmm.
And they didn't want to leave. And it wasn't just because the nuns had bussed them down. they really loved it, and they identified with it. It was part of who they are. So it becomes harder and harder with every passing week for people to continue to reconcile that urge to come home and to stay home in New Orleans with the actual reality of what their lives are like. And but it was cool because these were 14 to 18 year old kids who, they're just full of optimism.
Hmm.
And mm-hmm. It will get better. And in their lifetimes, probably before they're young adults, they'll have the opportunity to live something like they used to.
Unless another hurricane strikes, right?
Yeah. Well, that's always been the risk.
Right.
There. And I think that we've gone now through. Well, we've gone through one hurricane season, and we're into the second, and have yet to have a repeat. And every time New Orleans goes through one of those and comes out unscathed, I think people will feel more and more confident again. But I'll tell you that when I was down there during that time, I mean, when it rained hard, you could just tell people were flipping out
right.
a little. It was just. One of the women that I spent time with interviewing and getting to know her family and so on, one time it was raining really hard, and she called me up nearly in the middle of the night and said, "I'm going out to check to see how the pumps are working.
Hmm.
You want to come?" And I said, "Okay." So we just raced around in her minivan, checking to see if pump two was working. And this was a woman, she was 50 years old. Her father, when she was a kid, had taught her where all the pumps were in the city and, how they worked.
Oh.
And she's just obsessed with the water. I mean, you could tell people, when it was raining, people got really uptight about it, especially when it flooded. I would speculate that doesn't happen as much as it did in those first few months.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Duncan. Duncan Merle is our guest. Perhaps some of you have had a chance to see his current piece in this month's Harper Magazine, In the Year of the Storm, The Topography of Resurrection in New Orleans. Duncan is a writer, and he's based actually in North Carolina, but he went to New Orleans very shortly after the storm and spent almost a year there talking to people and looking at resilience and looking at demonstration and looking at why the people stayed and writing a beautiful piece about what this city is. Well, we welcome your phone calls. He can also respond to what's happened with the Army Corps of Engineers, what's happened with those FEMA trailers, how much of the city has been rebuilt, what the people think about efforts on the part of the state administration, the mayoral administration in New Orleans, and the federal government in terms of making that city vital again. Would you like to join us? Here is our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, you can reach us at 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And we have lines. It's hard to believe it's almost 2 years now since Hurricane Katrina. What's the city like now? I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Duncan. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And start our calls with George from La Crosse. Hi, George.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you very much for this guest. I'm from the Gulf Coast originally. And I worked in and out of New Orleans for quite a few years of my life. And, you know, it's amazing to me that Mississippi, with the former head of the Republican Party, gets money to fix the state, and Louisiana, which has a governor that's a Democrat, does not. New Orleans is a unique city in the world, let alone the U.S. The music, the art, the food, the melange that exists there, it's, you know, for no other reason than it being a cultural icon, I honestly believe more needs to be done. And what has been done just is not, you know, it is poorly planned and poorly executed. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Start, if you would, please, with Mississippi's getting more money in its politics. It's Democrat, Republican at play here, Duncan. Do you think that's true?
Well, there's certainly a very strong circumstantial case to be made for it, that the fact that as a percentage of relief money that has been appropriated by Congress, Mississippi has gotten a higher percentage, whether you figure it based on the amount of damage, physical damage that was incurred, economic damage that was incurred, or, you know, loss of human life. You know, what happened in New Orleans is often this comparison people try to make this comparison between Mississippi and Louisiana or Mississippi and New Orleans. The truth is that what happened in Mississippi was a hurricane that came over the beach with a flood surge and did what hurricanes do. And I live in North Carolina, and this is what happened. That's typical hurricane behavior. If you live on the coast in a hurricane area, that's what happened. What happened in New Orleans was not damage. I mean, the majority of the damage that happened, the majority of the loss of life, and the ongoing economic damage that's going to remain with New Orleans for many years, was not the result of Hurricane Katrina directly. Hurricane Katrina, like I've said, was a Category 3 hurricane when it crossed over land east of New Orleans and was, you know, had Category 1 or Category 2 winds. New Orleans flooded because the levee system broke. And, you know, New Orleans is like a bowl. And so as soon as all that water flowed into the city, I mean, we're talking about 200,000, 300,000 structures that are, you know, were catastrophically damaged. That far, far outweighs what happened in Mississippi. Now, this is not to discount the terrible things that happened in Mississippi, or for that matter in Alabama, or in parts of Texas. We also shouldn't forget that there was another hurricane in that season, Hurricane Rita, which had quite a devastating effect on western Louisiana and parts of eastern Texas.
Yes.
Along the Gulf Coast. But the thing that happened in New Orleans is just absolutely unique. The fact that those levees that were supposed to hold did not, and allowed, you know, water, like water into a bathtub, and caused damage that is unlike what you see in Mississippi. What you see in Mississippi is typical hurricane damage, although bad hurricane damage. What happened in New Orleans, dwarfs it in scale.
Right. Thanks very much for the call. Did you have every intention of spending close to a year when you went to report there, or did you just get caught up and lost track of time?
Oh, I had meant to spend 8 months there, and by 6 months, I was begging my wife to come home. But interestingly enough, now this shouldn't say anything about the state of our marriage, but she encouraged me to stay those last 2 months. And it was those last 2 months that I really began to understand what I had done, or what I had seen, and, you know, what it is that I might be able to write about what I had seen. So, you know, as usual, I owe it all to my wife. But she's very supportive. Well, she had to be very supportive because, you know, I would come home. I would go down there for 3 weeks and come back for a week, which wasn't a lot of time during that time. And it took me a while after I got back to sort of settle back into normal life.
Mm-hmm.
What was your question?
How long you plan to stay there?
Oh, well, so I planned to stay for the 8 months. I wanted to stay to the anniversary, August 29th.
I see.
And the closer that I got to that day, the more it became this sort of, I was sort of revolted by the whole idea of an anniversary about Hurricane Katrina. You know, they planned all these events and concerts and, you know, various memorial ceremonies and so on and so forth. And it was just, what's interesting about it in America is that we do this for disasters and for, we commemorate them. But typically the people who, or for instance, the Oklahoma City bombing, we do this also. But typically the people who go and participate, the people who are standing there, you know, holding the candle or singing the hymn, are the very same people who have been suffering through the aftermath every day and have not forgotten it once. It's done for the cameras so that, you know, the rest of America can take a look and remember for a moment and then move on. And it was just, it became this awful day. I hated the idea of August 29th. And I left about a day or two before. I was ready to go to a lot of these memorial things, but another hurricane appeared in the Gulf, and I took it as an excuse to pack up my car and go.
We go next to Renee from Great Lakes. Hi, Renee.
Hi, how you doing? I'm calling because I'm glad to hear that this gentleman is talking about this situation. I'm from New Orleans, and I'm living in Illinois like 2 years later, you know, after the storm. And it's been very difficult recuperating, like myself, my grandmother, all my family still split up. We all want to go back. We haven't gotten, like, any help from FEMA. I don't know how they work, but they give it to who they want to give it to or whatever. I don't know how they go about it, but it's been very hard being in Illinois. It's just a whole new atmosphere, and he's absolutely right. There's something about New Orleans that you cannot shake out of your mind and out of your spirit. And, I mean, everything's different, the weather, the way we talk, the food even. Like, we can't go to the store and get fresh seafood, and we go out of our minds because we know, like, if we were at home, we could just walk down the street and get a bag of crawfish or some fresh catfish. And it's been very difficult, but I thank him a lot for talking about this because people have forgotten about what's happened. What happened was a tragedy. And I hope it never happens to anybody else. And we're still suffering all over the country.
How did you find how did you happen to go to Illinois, Renee?
At the time, I was in the military, and so they wound up sending a lot of people different places. Mm. So I wound up going to Great Lakes, Illinois, because there's a military installation up here, you know, the Navy base.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And because I have no place to go, I wound up kind of getting stuck up here. And what made matters worse, where I couldn't go back home, the contractors I hired to fix my home took my insurance money. So I'm in litigation about that right now. So it's like I can't afford to go back right now, but I'm going to. You know, it's just been real hard. It's heartbreaking at times. You know, holidays come, or like Mardi Gras came this year, and nobody knew but me. And, like, normally it'd be my family. We'd be out celebrating, you know, going to a parade or something. And it was just another day in Illinois,
right,
you know.
Right.
Thank you.
You know, thanks for the call, Renee. Duncan?
Well, she brings up a lot of points that are pretty common experiences that people have had. You know, people were scattered all over the country, and it's difficult to get back, especially if you didn't have a lot of means to begin with, or, you know, you're trying to make your rent wherever you've ended up, and also, for instance, let's say you're a homeowner in New Orleans. You're trying to make your rent in, you know, Great Lakes, Illinois, and also trying to pay your mortgage on an inhabitable house in New Orleans just to keep it. It becomes difficult, you know. And then, you know, people rely on family a lot. This is another good point for her to bring up. Families are big, both as social organizing units and, you know, also for, you know, finding jobs. People were even that woman, as you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, the woman with the bag who I almost ran into with my car when I first arrived, she had a big extended family all over the city, and she never was going to be not taken care of. People might get frustrated with her and put her out, but she was going to be taken care of. So family was important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should also say something about the money. This was one of the crueler things that's happened to people, and it's hard to express, but I'll try. And it's that from the beginning, in the month or so after the hurricane came, you know, politicians began promising money to people. It would have been less cruel to make no promises than to make promises that then get pushed off month after month after month. At the moment, there was money appropriated by Congress to help supplement the money that homeowners were receiving from their insurance companies, for instance. And this was to be funneled through the state and administered by a state recovery authority, Louisiana Recovery Authority, through a private contractor who would actually make the grant. That money didn't even begin to show up in New Orleans until the fall of 2006, which was more than a year afterward. Now, this money was not a handout. What this money was it was meant to just specifically be the difference between what an insurance company settled with a homeowner for and what the actual cost of rebuilding a house was. And I'm not talking about, you know, making it fancy and getting a new kitchen. I'm talking about, you know, just replacing the house with something similar or, you know, clearing it out. Well, what they found is there was something along the lines of $5 billion that was ultimately available for this purpose. What they found is that insurance companies settled for so much less than they had even predicted that they're going to run about 50% short with that fund. Mm. In other words, the first 50% of the people who now have begun to get money, their shortfall was so great that they're going to break that little fund, big fund, well before they are able to cover everyone who is eligible and registered. So the point here is that for the longest time, people were told they were going to get money. People were said they were going to be told, they were told that they would be helped. The president went down to Jackson Square and said this very specifically. Had he not said that, had he just said something terrible has happened to you, we'll do the best we can to help you, that would have been great. But he said, we will do everything to restore, build this city back to what it was. And That's not happened. And yet the promise has been held over people's heads to the point that you can't make a decision about what you're going to do, whether you're going to return or not, whether you're going to rebuild your house or not. Because as long as this possibility that someone's going to give you money, then you can't make a proper decision.
And the promise is still there? The hope is still there?
Well, the hope, yes. The hope is still there. People are still, I mean, it's not just the federal government's money that people have been expecting to get a little piece of. People are still wrangling with their insurance companies over what is covered and what's not covered. And that's a whole other story, which is not, which is pretty detailed, but it's, I think it's one of the more horrifying details of everything that's going on here is how difficult it's been for people to deal with their insurance companies and how the realization that when you insure your house, you may not be insuring it for every and all damage that might occur to it.
Yes, and we're talking 2 years after this storm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm one of the women that I've featured in this article, she still has not gone back to her house in Lakeview. It's been gutted, but she's not sure where she's going to end up living. She's still renting a house so that her kids can continue to go to school, but has no idea what to do with it, doesn't know what money she's going to have available.
Hmm.
It would have been better to say, we're not giving you a dime. Because then people could have made their decision.
Right. So there are thousands of people, as you said, like Renee, who are living in various places in the country. Some of them were just put on airplanes. They didn't know where they were going. Some
right.
of them wound up here in Milwaukee. What is the – when will this be settled for them? For those people who would like to go home, you can still hear a hope in her voice. Do you think that that will happen for her and for others who want to go home?
Well, it all depends on so many things. You know, what what is their financial situation? What is the situation with their house? What is, you know, what skills do they bring? I mean, what jobs could they possibly have? I mean, one of the things to realize is that the, you know, the number of jobs that was lost after that hurricane in New Orleans is great. And I'm not just talking about, you know, service sector jobs in hotels and restaurants, but, you know, jobs working on the waterfront, jobs working in refineries, jobs working in oil rigs, jobs doing all sorts of building trades. There aren't that many left. So it all depends on what someone can come and bring back to the city and whether they can be employed.
Duncan Merle is our guest. Current piece in this month's Harper's Magazine, In the Year of the Storm, The Topography of Resurrection in New Orleans. He spent close to a year right after the hurricane struck gathering the story. And this is what we're talking about this hour. Thank you, Renee, very much for your call. Let's go next to Karen from Galena, Illinois. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Thank you so much for doing this. It's very important that we keep the information about New Orleans out there. I was born and raised in New Orleans, left at the age of 26 when I married a naval officer and moved around. My father and mother, who are 87, are living with me now because they lost their home in Katrina. Mm. So I'm very vested. Two things I'd like to discuss. One is the history of New Orleans. Young man was talking about how people want to live there and don't want to move away. It's a very emotional thing to live in New Orleans. It's a great place. The attitude of the people of rebuilding is also a wonderful thing. The history of the city is such that from the very beginning, it was devastated by hurricanes, floods, fire, yellow fever, and people developed an attitude, a very strong attitude of rebuilding and live for today because tomorrow you may die. And the most important thing in life is family and friends. And that attitude just got stronger and stronger, and that's why it's such a wonderful place to live, because family and friends mean everything, and you get together with them often, and you celebrate everything, and Mardi Gras is just one of the celebrations. There are celebrations that happen at the drop of a hat. And so people want to go back there, and they want to be with their friends and family. The other thing that I wanted to touch on is the fact that he brought up how there are missing important professions there. The highly skilled people are leaving. Right now, 90% of the psychiatrists have left at a time when people really need psychiatrists in that city. And the other thing is, we're always saying we're the richest country, the strongest country, the best country in the world. And yet the Dutch have these incredible dikes and things to hold back the floods of the North Sea. And we have these little levees that are just so insignificant to the water that we have surrounding us. And it all boils down to politics and lousy politics. We could have those wonderful things. I heard this, I don't know if it's true, that the Dutch offered to come and advise us, and the president told them, no, we didn't need them. But we need to face up to the fact that politics is part of the problem here. And people blame the Corps of Engineers, but the Corps of Engineers is only given so much money from the federal government, and they do the best that they can, which is sometimes a poor job because they just don't have enough money to do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I want to thank you very much for doing this program.
How are your parents doing?
My mom is in a nursing home, and she's actually doing better here than she was there. And my father is a very strong, credible man, has never complained, never, never complained. And I just love him, and I just respect him so much. But he's doing very well, and we're just very glad to have him. And I have family there, of course, and they're struggling every day. And, you know, I have friends who say, oh, people are complaining in New Orleans. And you do hear complaints, but I want to tell you that they're more, and I really think they are heroes there, who just have picked up and have repaired their house, like this gentleman said, on their own with their own monies. And basically, the bottom line, I think everyone has learned from this, is don't ever depend on the government to help you. You're just going to have to do it yourself. And no matter what the tragedy that strikes us, we're going to have to take care of ourselves and help each other.
Thank you, Karen, so much for being with us. These stories are so moving, Duncan.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, she brings up a lot of great points. It should be emphasized that, you know, it's been terrible on New Orleanians for them to get this reputation for being, you know, pathetic and, you know, unable to take care of themselves. It's hard to talk about the residents of a city as a people, but the city itself has been remarkably resilient. She mentions this. You know, the city burned twice. It flooded constantly through 300 years of its history. You know, the yellow fever, cholera, measles epidemics, you know, have killed thousands at a time when there was not. But people kept coming back and kept rebuilding. Family is really important. And, you know, one of the perceptions that also, I think, irks people from New Orleans is that, you know, they are a drunk and dissolute lot. And one of the ways this gets expressed is through national representations of Mardi Gras. And she mentioned Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras to New Orleanians is, you know, that's a family event. That's an occasion for reunion. Most of the time, families will go out and they'll see the various crews do their parades, and their parades might be in Metairie or in New Orleans or uptown or in mid-city or someplace. And they, you know, there's this tradition of building ladders that you can, with seats on the top for the kids to sit on. And, you know, nobody's getting, you know, horrendously drunk or drunk at all. And it was for the kids. It was like going out and seeing the circus come to town. However, the impression of Mardi Gras is Bourbon Street.
Right.
And Bourbon Street is like the, you know, the tourist containment area for New Orleans. It's a place that New Orleanians rarely go. In my impression, that's not their culture at all. I remember one time walking by a bar on Bourbon Street and hearing, you know, a cover band playing Journey, and thinking to myself, this is probably the only bar in New Orleans where you could hear a cover band playing anything, let alone Journey. Because, you know, New Orleanians love music, and they have real bands, and they, so it's a resilient place, and, you know, it's just awful to, for me to witness this city sort of, you know, having to put its hand out for help, and the rest of us, you know, wondering whether they should have ever lived there in the first place,
right.
Which is a really odd question to ask of anyone about where they live, I think, especially if that city's been there for 300 years.
Duncan Merle is our guest. He has a piece in this month's Harper's Magazine, In the Year of the Storm, The Topography of Resurrection in New Orleans. Duncan is a writer who lives in North Carolina, and he, right after the hurricane struck, went to New Orleans and spent 8 months gathering this multi-layered story. To your phone calls, more of them in a moment. Thanks so much for the call, Karen. We have one line open. Our lines have been crowded. Still a great deal of interest in this story. Well, we'll pause for a moment and return. 800-486-8655 is our number, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now for Duncan, and Jim is next from Juneau. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to hear you on, Duncan. You kind of shadowed a lot of things I experienced. My family and I were trapped in our home less than 12, 14 blocks from the beach in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, which is in Hancock County, just east, 45 minutes east of New Orleans, and pretty much the eye hit pretty much there, West Pearl River area. You shed a lot of things that I noticed. I was able to go back summer 2006. My wife and my daughters didn't really get to see a lot of the devastation I saw. We ended up riding out in the second floor, and then our building became unstable. We found some friends, got a vehicle running, and moved to an elementary school in the northern part of the county and slept on a gym floor for 5 days. We're all natives of Wisconsin. I took a job there in 2000 with a company, and we came, you know, pretty much part of the larger family there on the coast. And it's been a real nightmare for us as far as the federal side of it, dealing with FEMA and things and insurance companies, because we got out of there about a week after the storm because I wanted to get my girls safe again. We had somewhat of a family infrastructure back home here in Wisconsin. Thankfully for them, you know, got us a place to stay. I got my girls back into a school they used to attend. They still had friends here. My last trip back last summer, I spent a few days there, and to have it look pretty much the way it did the day we left was disheartening. And I was looking at some of the federal monies and where they went and how they distributed them. I actually met with Mayor Eddie Farr from Bay St. Louis and Tommy Longo from Waveland, two adjoining communities, were pretty much wiped off the map, the entire infrastructure destroyed in both those towns. And they're telling me, yeah, they're saying there was all this money available, but now all of a sudden this town, which basically doesn't exist anymore, only by name, would have to come up with a certain portion of matching funds.
That's right.
To $300,000, which was just blowing their minds. They're trying to get their crippled cities back together, and you know, we shed a few tears together, me and Mayor Favre. He's just like, I can't put my city back together fast enough. All my people are gone. I need to keep them safe. And actually, I had two occasions I was back there, and it was the same story 6 months apart. As far as my family and us here, you know, my wife was recovering from knee replacement surgery and then the onset of post-traumatic stress, so she's been on meds for that. Now, the last 2 years we've been in Wisconsin, just struggling with insurance companies on vehicles that we lost. The irony of it is they wanted someone to meet them there, not having even a dime to our names to even get back down there and meet
them. To meet
them
in where, in New Orleans?
Back in our home in Bay St. Louis, you know, they want, you know, FEMA. We got the FEMA run around twice. We had to restart our claim three times these last 2 years. We just finally started getting rental assistance this March, almost 2 years later. So we've had a hard time with all that. You know, the insurance company wanted to look at the vehicles that had since been pretty much bulldozed away and trucked out as fast as they could move the debris.
No.
So there's physically no vehicle to inspect, so you're kind of SOL. I mean, these are all material things that can be replaced, but, you know, to leave a state that I lived in for 5 years with my family, and it became our home, and all the friends that we still have there that are struggling, and some still in trailers, and as of last summer, some were still waiting for trailers in the summer of 2006. And it was just very you know, hard to see that same struggle was still going on. Not to belittle, you know, the problems that New Orleans had, but like Duncan had said earlier, that their circumstances were a bit different. They weren't in a direct correlation to the hurricane. It was everything else in their infrastructure that was set in place to protect the city from the floodwaters that result from any type of coastal storm that comes there, you know, year in and year out.
Right.
So, you know, you'll have that struggle. So some people say, well, Mississippi got all this money and then New Orleans isn't getting this. I mean, I've seen kind of both sides of it. My company had a factory in Lafayette, Louisiana, which a week later, Rita hit that. So we kind of got on both ends. We had facilities in both states, and I commuted quite a bit all across that part of the country for my job. And, you know, the stories were the same all over, back and forth. I probably ended up with about 16 hours of footage the last summer I was down there. I could probably do my own documentary, but, you know, anything to just still keep this story at the forefront is very important for, you know, either side of the Mississippi. I mean,
yes,
they were all equally devastated, and, you know, we're struggling to get back on our feet back here in,
yes,
Wisconsin. There's always that yearning to go back somewhat. You know, they say you have survivor's remorse, which kind of did set in 6 months after we got back. You know, even though we got someplace safe at family and infrastructure, we still had friends and things down there that were still struggling even to get a roof over their heads, you know.
It is amazing how many people are still struggling in a significant way, Duncan.
Yes, and you know, he outlines a lot of the way that in many small arenas, you know, it's just people are just continually picked at and picked at and picked at. They, you know, they're struggling with their insurance company. They're struggling with the Small Business Administration. They're struggling with FEMA. They're struggling with, you know, their local government, you know, whether they're going to be the electrical company, the power company, the gas company, the water company. I mean, it's just on and on and on. I knew people who had, you know, the water company on their speed dial and the electrical company on their speed dial because they had to constantly be calling these folks up. I mean, it can wear you out. And, you know, I think that people down there experience this, but it can be worse for people who are not there right now, but are trying from a distance to, you know, preserve what little bit they have left down there. And, you know, Americans talk as if, you know, they're sick of this story. They may be sick of my story, but what happened in New Orleans, you know, that's a dead story. It's over. It's 2 years ago now. You know, it's really, that's very disheartening to me, our lack of attention span. You know, we just experienced July 4th, and, you know, we all got together and we celebrated the birth of our nation. Well, if we are really a nation, then, you know, nations rise up and take care of themselves.
Absolutely, they do.
And, you know, when they don't, when it's simply a question of, you know, I'm with you until you're costing me something, and then, you know, I'm going to nickel and dime you, and I'm going to question you at every turn. Why did you live there? You know, what kind of person are you? You know, that was an issue that was brought up at different times. You know, that this was a dissolute, like I said, a dissolute and sinful city, and maybe it deserved what it got. I mean, can you imagine that? And then we're talking about a city that is 300 years old, nearly, and has contributed greatly to our society. I mean, we ought to be bending over backwards to take care of the city. And I don't mean necessarily that, you know, the federal government is responsible to make everybody whole and then some. But if the federal but this federal government is, and governments are, the way that we as a nation express ourselves or act as a group. And, you know, if we can't come together and do this for people all across the Gulf Coast who are suffering, you know, then how do we claim to be a nation, you know, of that, and have that word mean anything?
Very well said. And how can you go down to Mississippi and show your insurance agency pictures that your cars were damaged when you don't have the cars? They're gone.
Yeah. Well,
oh, that would drive you nuts.
It would. Well, of course it does, you know, and I remember there was a congressman from Mississippi, and I've forgotten his name, has slipped my mind for the moment, but I remember watching him on a local television show talking about He had a house on the coast in Mississippi, vacation home, that had been basically utterly leveled.
Have to make it short. We're almost out of time.
And anyway, he pointed up into a tree and said, "There's my roof." Up there to his insurance adjuster, and the insurance adjuster still claimed that all the damage was because of the flood instead of the wind.
Right. Thank you, Duncan, very much for your work.
Well, thank you for having me.
Duncan Merle, his piece is in this month's Harper's Magazine, In the Year of the Storm, The Topography of Resurrection in New Orleans. Thanks to John Treader and Eleanor Heidkamp-Young for on-air production here today. And thanks to Rita Thomas for producing this program. Thank you, everyone, for all of your calls. I'm glad we're not forgetting to cover this story. It's still a large story, isn't it? We have news coming up. And we'll return with more Thursday, July 5 conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute now before 10 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.